Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Nation Fermented, Beer, Bavaria, and the Making of Modern Germany by Robert Shea Terrell. Narrated by Mike Lenz. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to images present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. In a smoke-filled, working-class bar in Depression-era Berlin, a waiter delivers two glasses of beer to a table, adds the drinks to the coaster tallies, and moves on. One of the men at the table, Herr Volker, ponders his drink briefly before turning to his fellow communist, Herr Stoppel. "If I put a British beer here," he begins with an unmistakable Berlin accent, "and here a hearty Mola Helles, which one would you drink?" Stoppel answers as expected. He chuckles and declares he would prefer to drink the local Helles. "Of course." Volka proceeds with a series of follow-ups, centering on where the Helles is from. It is brewed in Berlin. But where is Berlin? On the Spree River. But where is the Spree? In Germany. "That's right," declares Volka. "In Germany. In our Germany. Think that over." Volka's line of questioning echoes an earlier conversation he had with the leader of his son's Hitler youth group. In that instance, Volka was led through similar questions, again building toward the importance of the German nation as a foremost frame of reference. As he prods Stoppel along, Volka links local beer to his national awakening, questioning his communist convictions in favor of German nationalism and, presumably, national socialism. This scene comes from Hitler Junge Quecks, the first major Nazi propaganda film, which premiered about 8 months after Adolf Hitler's appointment as chancellor. The bar conversation, and the film more broadly, reflect the intense battle between the Nazis and their opponents on the left, most notably the communists. In this working-class bar, beer provides an opportunity for the characters, and presumably the audience, to consider the national stakes of the mundane. The Helles creates cultural distance from Britain, and its origins in Berlin lead the characters to think of the city not as an industrial, workers' city on the Spree, a hub of international communism, but rather as part of a communal and national whole. Our Germany. From the perspective of the 21st century, it seems self-evident that beer from Berlin is German beer, and that drinking it has something to do with being German. But if that were simply the case, Herr Stoppel should not need three chances and gentle prodding to make the realization. As a piece of national socialist propaganda, the film, unsurprisingly, puts a national belonging front and center, over and above socioeconomic, local, or international loyalties and sentiments. In so doing, the scene illuminates how the German nation was and remains contested across multiple layers of connectivity and exchange, from the local pub to geopolitical conflict. Expanding our gaze beyond Berlin, the scene is yet more revealing in what it silences. Consider the seemingly obvious choice of the local Mola Helles. The Helles style was not a Berlin classic, but rather a relatively new style invented in 1894 at the Munich Spaten Brewery to compete with the ascendant hegemony of Pilsner beer. The two were among several lager-style beers, defined by their use of bottom-fermenting yeast, that took Central Europe and the world by storm in the 19th and 20th centuries. Lager spread from Bavaria and Bohemia outward, at least in part thanks to imperial expansion, migration, and rapid economic development, both in Europe and beyond. In northern Germany, these brews were initially despised and discursively othered through the pejorative moniker Bavarian beer. But with the explosion of urban and industrial development around the turn of the century, Bavarian beer increasingly became the standard, especially for the working classes. By the time Hitlerjunge Quex was produced, Southern brewing standards and industrial cultures of production had solidified the association between lager and urban workers in Berlin and beyond. This scene provides two of the main analytic threads that run throughout this book. The first is discursive. Just as Berlin and Germany are framed as nationalist rather than communist, beer provides a reference for articulations of place well beyond the 1930s. Throughout the period studied here, from the late 19th century to the end of the 20th, producers, regulators, lobbyists, advertisers, and consumer interest groups repeatedly laid claim to the political and cultural lives of the German people. That is, the very nature of our Germany, as Volker put it in the film. But moving beyond discourse, the second thread is structural. The beer in the scene can only be claimed as German because of an earlier process by which Southern brewing practices and standards transformed production and consumption in the industrializing city. Just as Bavarian beer became a Berlin staple, Southern brewing standards and industrial values became increasingly national. The hearty Mole Helles thus not only functions as an object of Nazi claims to the nation, its unspoken history also testifies to how a Southern style of beer transformed the landscape of production and consumption. Underpinning this particular Nazi contest over Berlin, it turns out, is a longer transformation of the city at the hands of Southern practice. A bottom-fermented history of Germany. Perhaps no commodity is as tightly entwined with the German nation as beer. But this is not a natural or timeless association. Indeed, the very idea of German beer is relatively new. For centuries, German-speaking Europe boasted a plurality of cultures and regulations around the production, sale, and consumption of beer. The emergence of something recognizable as German beer and the imbrication of commodity and place are at the heart of this book. And, as the opening film analysis indicates, the chapters that follow emphasize the role of Southern, and more pointedly Bavarian, influence on the national whole. A Nation Fermented argues that Bavarian traditions and interests consistently shaped both beer and the German nation more broadly, from production standards and tax law to public health policy and consumer sensibilities. Given the popularity of beer in Germany, it is perhaps not surprising that a great deal has been written about the subject. By and large, this scholarship takes one of several forms, from business histories of prominent breweries to localized studies of consumer practices and industrialization. Much of this work parallels other international histories of beer and brewing in a particular context: how technological or political shifts impacted brewing and commerce, or what sorts of consumer practice emerged among different social demographics. Far too often, the inclination in histories of beer has been to add the drink and the industry to relatively well-known stories. This book, by contrast, analyzes rather than assumes the relationship between beer and Germany. In many ways, then, it is not a history of beer, and it certainly does not set out to analyze what beer meant to individual Germans throughout time and space. Instead, this is a history of Germany revealed through beer. It employs beer as a lens that reveals how the structures and practices of the German nation were transformed from the south up. Germany has always been and remains a cultural and political patchwork, but this book grants the proposition, usually a dubious honor for Prussia alone, that one region can shape the nation. In their effort to repeal a Prussian-centered history, culminating in Germany's grasps for world power, scholars have emphasized numerous regions and locales, highlighting plurality and negotiations between larger and smaller scales of belonging. But less attention has been given to precisely how those locales transform the nation itself, particularly after the first half of the 20th century. In this book, provincialism not only directly shapes the national whole throughout the century, it is also part of Germany's shifting global presence. As we will learn, Bavarian production practices and imagery inform not only the laws and consumer culture of beer in Germany, but also the international embrace of a set of beer-centric Oktoberfest stereotypes of Germany around the world. This book builds on recent assertions that there is no singular German nation or singular way to envision German history, and reveals a particular story of how provincial interests transformed different iterations of the nation-state throughout the 20th century. It suggests another way that the periphery became central to the course of the nation and extends scholarship on provincialism not only beyond its conventional periodization in the decades before the First World War, but also into the global context. The central argument of this book can be broken down into three main components, each building on the last. First, brewers across Germany, but particularly in Bavaria, were fiercely loyal to regional traditions, regularly prioritizing local values in their business calculations. They were no doubt profit seekers, but they were also capitalists with a provincial face, and their actions must be understood in the context of such commitments. Second, the staunch regionalism of brewers and their legislative allies fundamentally shaped the production and regulation of beer across several iterations of the German nation-state. Whether in tax law or the fits and starts of European integration, Bavarians' ongoing intransigence and refusal to compromise regional tradition informed the economic, political, and social structures of Germany more broadly. Finally, regional identities and practices also pervaded the cultural discourse of Germany as a place. Bavarian brewers and legislators led the nation in its embrace of beer purity as a hallmark of German commercial sentiments and propped up an international stereotype of the beer-drinking Oktoberfest German, in many cases stripped of its Bavarian origins. More than a history of modern Germany plus beer, A Nation Fermented uses beer to reframe how we think about modern Germany as a place under construction. From the late 19th century to the end of the 20th, the combined economic and regulatory power of intransigent Bavarian brewers, regulators, and others repeatedly transformed the production, consumption, and political economy of beer in Germany. Provincialism and Capitalism. Understanding the actions of brewers, regulators, and marketers requires taking seriously that they repeatedly prioritized not just bottom lines, but also local traditions. In disputes over the taxation of beer, a hot-button issue from the 1870s to the 1950s, or arguments about the inclusion of sugar, a topic which flared up in every decade of the 20th century, Bavarian brewers and regulators invoked tradition, secured political allies, and wielded what levers of power were available to pursue regional interests. But profit and tradition were not always clearly separate. In some cases, Bavarian commitment to tradition appears as a sort of provincial curiosity. But in other cases, brewers, regulators, and marketers actively invented or reinvented traditions, infusing their practices with new meanings for the sake of political and economic utility. Until the late 1940s, for example, Bavarian brewers held to their practice of, and legal protections for, brewing without the addition of sugar. But from the 1950s onward, they promoted the practice as a marker of regional and later national culture, elevating the so-called Reinheitsgebot, or beer purity law, as a national icon. While brewers, of course, desired profit, they also sought to retain their provincial identities. In the Reinheitsgebot, Bavarian brewers and their commercial and regulatory partners found a means to reconstruct both their industry and a bounded sense of cultural belonging in a series of integration moments. From the first years of the new West Germany to the early stages of European integration, and from the mounting influence of the United States to national reunification in 1989-90. Rather than examining the particulars of Bavaria proper, or even the beer itself, this book reimagines how a single region shaped the nation both from within and from without. It reveals how an unsuspecting, regionally weighted industry informed both shifting iterations of the German nation and its symbolic presence on the global stage. Historians of the 19th century have been particularly insightful in their efforts to place the nation within a broad spectrum of connections. Classic studies of provincialism have shown, for instance, that local loyalties and identities existed side by side with national ones, and in fact, that the former often supplied the lens for imagining the latter. Outside the German case, too, Colleen Guy has demonstrated how, in the case of Champagne and France, regional commercial interests could be pivotal in the construction of national identities. At the same time, but quite divorced analytically, other scholars have shown that the legal, discursive, and social practices that defined regions or the nation took shape in a transnational or global register of preconditions, connections, imaginaries, and transgressions. The present book represents an effort to bridge these conversations, combining local histories with global and transnational ones, in order to highlight the shifting constellations of forces that produce and shape the nation. A Nation Fermented thus uses beer to reveal how Germany, as global nation, is also Germany as provincial nation. Bavarian capital and regulatory interests operate across entanglements of scale from the local to the global. To be clear, the emphases on Bavaria and Munich should not suggest that regions or cities provide an analytic silver bullet that the nation-state does not. Beer and brewing, much like other goods and industries, depend on localized institutional power and cultural practice. They have particular centers and peripheries, and they are grown and sustained by their integrations and reconfigurations. The usage of Bavaria here, of course, refers to an evolving territorial state. The political boundaries of Bavaria changed in the period studied here, when the Palatinate, a Bavarian possession since the early 19th century, became part of a new federal state in West Germany. But beyond the political boundaries, we will also discover several scaled efforts to define and shape the structures and practices of something uniformly Bavarian. Indeed, Bavaria has long been a region of localities, fragmented by intense divisions of religion, culture, and history. But in the post-war moment, brewers and regulators sought to consolidate regional practice. Beginning in the 1950s, producers and their legislative allies in Munich and Upper Bavaria worked to influence and align production and consumption practices among Franconians that welcomed beer from other West German states into their homes and restaurants. In this case, old Bavarian capital and regulatory interests fought to homogenize Bavarian commercial practices in a long-contested cultural and political battleground. Bavaria has a marked Janus face, as Der Spiegel put it in 1964, characterized by external struggles against every form of centralization, but from within, centralism at any price. Viewing this subregional process of defining Bavarian practice in Franconia in the same frame as Bavarian influences on national laws or international stereotypes reveals a series of nested interactions. Relationships, such as those between Old Bavaria and Franconia, between southern Germany and Berlin, or between Munich and the Cold War West, are each fluid and intersecting. Across them, brewers regulators, and marketers, with an interest in the success of Bavarian beer, shaped the structures and discourses both of the market and broader cultural identities. As this sketch of provincial interests suggests, this book focuses on places and processes that depart from the classic preserves of capitalism, whether material, that is, coal, steel, or cotton, organizational, industrial labor and consolidated capital, or geographical, Britain, the Ruhr, and other industrial centers. A more conventional history of capitalism centered on beer in Germany might revolve around Bremen, the Rhineland, or Dortmund in particular. These are commonsensical sites of inquiry, home to a consolidated handful of massive breweries. But the history of capitalism, in both the German case and well beyond it, has increasingly broken with such conventional categories, fruitfully diversifying our understanding of capitalism and even the very concept of capital. To borrow Kenneth Lipartito's words, Bavarian brewers, regulators, marketers, and other stakeholders repeatedly drew on multiple motives and complicated subjectivities, bringing together forms of knowledge, localized practices, and varied governance structures to shape markets and commercial cultures. Local and regional loyalties to tradition regularly cut across the placeless and valueless profit-making motivations we so often assume to characterize the modern business world. Beyond the aforementioned insistence on the Reinheitsgebot, Bavaria retained a notably decentralized industry structure, unique in comparison to most major beer-producing regions of the world until quite recently. While the number of breweries undoubtedly shrank in the period studied here, Bavarians insisted that industry decentralization was a crucial marker of their industry and culture. And, as we will discover in several chapters, this conviction, like the ubiquity of lager or the insistence on beer purity, likewise took on national significance. This is capitalism with a provincial face, where brewers sought profit in markets ranging from the local to the global, but also clung tightly to their local identities, rejecting centralization, open innovation, and any shred of faith in free markets. These histories of provincialism and capitalism operate on a broad foundation of commodity history. As a whole, this field grants that things take on different meanings across time and place, thereby revealing the appropriations, translations, and power differentials between different cultures and regimes of policy and practice. In recent years, commodity history has become so well established that new, seminal works rarely address such historiographical foundations, instead employing the lens to reframe other, often larger, stories. For example, historians have recently used commodities to reframe massive narratives, including the global histories of capitalism, industrialization, empire, and mass consumerism. Still, connections need to be granted to reveal the transformative power of commodity flows. While parts of this book follow beer beyond German borders, others drill down to interrogate the German case from within. Pulling commodity history into localized contexts and politics reveals how connections between different parts of the nation are just as in flux as those between opposite sides of the globe. In the German case, studies of commodities have become increasingly common. Works focusing on individual German states, Imperial, Nazi, and East Germany, for example, have used material goods to recast major historical narratives, from the astounding economic importance of the German colonies to the role of East German consumerism in driving socialist globalization. This book also sheds light on particular German states, the shifting political economy of the Länder in the Bonn Republic in Chapter 3, for example, but it also resonates with works that have used commodities, the Volkswagen or porcelain, to write across the broader siloing of political temporality that remains in German historiography. A Nation Fermented offers a history of material culture, grounded in the particulars of economic history, that points to the ways that provincial differences in economy and industry manifest in larger cultural transformations across the 20th century. German beer, integration, industrialization, and the rise of Lagerbier. While Germans have historically consumed a great deal of beer, the cultures of production and consumption have never been homogeneous. Indeed, German-speaking Europe has long boasted a complex mosaic of cultures and regulations around the production, sale, and consumption of beer. Amid the diversity, however, one can discern a north-south split in both production standards and beer styles. It emerged over the course of hundreds of years and echoes throughout the 20th century. Until the 19th century, a great deal of the production and consumption of beer in German-speaking Europe reflected the history of political fragmentation and decentralization, with states playing a crucial role. In the northern German lands, beer was most often produced by private individuals for private use, or, at times, by larger landowners, selling brews in their rural community for supplemental income. In smaller states and principalities, brewers developed a multitude of specialties, underpinning a remarkable degree of market diversity. Just north of Leipzig, for example, brewers in the town of Zerbst were known for beer made with rosemary, and in other northern German locales, beers contained everything from rye and herbs to spices and fruits. This proliferation of styles in northern Germany reflected a relative absence of regulations that did not maintain in southern Germany, especially in Bavaria, which was quite early in developing central sovereign legislation and administrative organization that manifested in numerous regulations on production, consumption, and sales. By far, the most famous regulation, known since the 20th century as the Reinheitsgebot, was issued in Munich in 1487 and expanded to the Kingdom of Bavaria in 1516. According to the regulation, which initially aimed to limit competition for grain in the production of beer and bread, beer could only contain water, hops, and malted barley. Innovation thus operated in a markedly narrower key as brewers developed techniques such as aggressively roasting malts. The Bavarian state also permitted a number of exceptions to the law. Most famously, Bavarian Weissbier, or Hefeweizen, which is brewed with wheat, was brewed by royal decree and royal monopoly from 1520 to 1798. The Bavarian Order of 1516 has become an icon of German beer, and, indeed, of Germany itself. This process is addressed in multiple chapters of what follows. But in the 16th century, it was soon joined by an equally important, if lesser known, regulation on seasonality. Brewers had long been aware that beer fermented in at least two major ways: faster in the warmer summer months, and slower in the colder winter ones. More often than not, heat-tolerant, top-fermenting yeast strands fermented brews in the summer, producing ale, while more cold-tolerant, bottom-fermenting yeasts fermented beer in winter, producing lager, so named because the beer was fermented more slowly while stored in a cool storage cellar, or Lagerkeller. By 1553, the Wittelsbach dynasty all but banned the production of beer in the summer months, thereby effectively halting the production of ale. With the exception of some beers, such as Weissbier, an ale that could still be produced in the summer by royal decree, the vast majority of beers in Bavaria would henceforth be bottom-fermented lager by default. The effect of these two 16th-century Bavarian regulations was a balance of market homogenization and standardization that would thrive in the face of industrialization and increasing scientific control. As one of the fathers of organic chemistry noted in 1840, compared to British, French, and most German brews, Bavarian Lagerbier had solved the problem of long-term storage, leading to the solution of one of the most beautiful problems of the theory of fermentation.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?